is a pre-recorded version of the WTKA Roundtable on WTKA, unsurprisingly, 9 o'clock Thursdays. It is recorded, though, so if you call in, nobody will answer you.
Bring on the round table. We've got Brian Cook. We've got Craig Ross. We've got Seth Fisher. Good morning, fellas. How are you?
Well.
How you doing? Doing okay.
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah to you. Well, Seth, the holiday is going to end at sundown tonight. I hope your family is enjoying the festival lights as the candles last. The oil lasts 8 days, people. The oil lasts 8 days. So how'd you guys enjoy yesterday? Did you have fun yesterday, Brian?
What happened yesterday?
Football season is over.
But that was Tuesday. Oh. That was Tuesday. Yesterday.
No, I just mean that you beat Ohio State pretty convincingly, and I was like, oh, I like that. That's good.
Mm-hmm. Your overall thoughts as the signing, the early signing day, or the first day of the early signing period wrapped up yesterday, Michigan announced 20 commits. They added two yesterday with the Donovan Edwards announcement and then the Jaden Hood announcement later on yesterday as well. So, Brian, what's your overall thoughts on the class coming after one day?
You know, given the chaos around the program, being able to hold that class together is very good, but it's not the kind of class that changes the paradigm here, right? Especially because you have one cornerback who's a three-star. You have one defensive tackle who's not ranked in the top 1,000. you had these like two kind of glaring personnel issues on this year's team, and you didn't really address them in this recruiting class. But five-star quarterback holding on to Xavier Worthy is amazing. As soon as Bama came up, I'm like, well, I mean, they have Devonta Smith. He's gone, but they managed to hold on to him, which is great. Edwards is a good pickup. So it's
Hey, Sam.
And we are live on the radio as well, Sam. He's not quite ready to
But so it's, you know, to be able to hold on to this class, and the kids actually in the class did a lot of holding on, is extremely encouraging. But at the same time, you know, Michigan's been recruiting at this level under Harbaugh for a few years now. And it's more about retention and development and trying to get over the hump against Ohio State. So I kind of feel like they're in the same place they were before.
My thought is even though the kid is a three-star, it's his name, McBurrows.
Yeah, McBurrows.
Yeah, he was offered by Alabama, Georgia, LSU, Ohio State. And the Alabama offer is serious. And the other thing is, Seth was kind enough to post an article that I wrote on MGo blog and Brian. And Michigan has done really well with guys outside of the top 1,000. And I think there's a reason for that. And they've done not so well with guys in, let's say, 300 to 500 range historically. And I think the reason is, or my theory is that guys who Michigan takes out of the top 1,000, since they're not generally regarded as real players or guys that are going to make a difference, they become very careful in their evaluations on. They're not going to take a guy outside of the top 1,000 unless they've really evaluated him. Whereas a guy sitting at number 250, they say, okay, everyone thinks he's good. They're maybe not quite as careful. At least that's my theory. And when I did that article, it showed that guys that were very low-rated guys, Ronnie Bell, Hassan Haskins come to mind right away, have actually panned out quite well. And guys in the more middle ranges, it's a lot more problematic. So I'm not concerned about a defensive tackle outside of the top 1,000. I'm kind of heartened by a defensive tackle outside of the top 1,000. I think there's maybe a greater chance that he works out. This is my spin and take, and we'll see. And I think it's, you know, recruiting ratings are fun. I love it. I love looking at them. But I'm not convinced. When you look, I mean, if you look at, say, Nebraska and Wisconsin over the last 15 years, Nebraska has blown Wisconsin away year after year after year and isn't even close. But who's been the better football team year after year after year? And so it may make a difference in the top two or three teams or four or five teams. Once you get outside of there, I'm not sure how much the ratings mean. I'm not sure how accurate these things actually are. That's just my take. I know I'm on an outlier position on this.
Well, Matt, Sam, you're muted, buddy.
I
and I may have missed this part.
Yeah.
The performance relative to what your expectations were. I did not expect them to be able to hold on to as many guys as they did. I thought this class would lose, most of their top guys as a result of the uncertainty. And all things considered, losing only two guys, not to diminish those guys is there as talents, but in the grand scheme of things, I thought Michigan, based on that, was one of the winners yesterday. ESPN put them as one of the losers.
Yeah.
Yesterday.
It's a very good point relative to expectations, and there's more time, right? One of the things about this year that I keep on wanting to remind people is that COVID has changed everything with rosters for next year and the year after that. That you have open transfers they just announced yesterday, so you can go off of anybody's roster, find defensive tackles you like, and say, "Hey, how's a Michigan degree sound?" And I mean, there are people who would bite at that. And then the year after that, everyone's going to be compressing their rosters because you've had this glut of players whose eligibility, and everyone's brought in another class, and so you can have another shot at it then too. So if you don't have the players on the roster now, there's opportunities to get them. I don't know who Michigan's going after. I don't know who is available. But I have to imagine if the program is stable, and that's a big if and when, but if the program is stable, there's a lot you can do before February to build this roster the way we need to.
So as you impact guys, I mean, as they were, I know we talk every single year about the the guy or guys that you think will be standouts. We got to wait to see it. I'm sure we're going to get some responses that say, "Hey, look, don't tell me, show me." But I'm just curious, as you guys look at this class, do you see any, do you predict or project any real true game breaker, star caliber performers among this group?
I mean, Worthy.
I agree.
First and foremost, you look at the guy who's running 10-5. Hundreds as a sophomore and probably would have run a 10-3, people were saying, if he actually had a track season this year. And you just watch his film and it's on another level. Like, he's the guy who immediately pops out as the guy who, whenever he steps on the field, is going to be one of the most talented people on it, no matter who he's playing. And then, other than that, I think El Hadi is the kind of guy who reminds me a lot of Jalen Mayfield. You know, he has a very similar recruiting story where Michigan found him at a camp, recruited him pretty early, and then the recruiting sites latched on to him because he's an extremely big man who was able to bend and is very flexible and can move.
Yeah, for me, I've looked at some of the tape, not all of them. Of course, Worthy just stands out, and you put him with the kid from Honolulu from last year, number 14, and it gives you an extraordinary amount of speed on the outside, which is nice. But I liked, of the kids I looked at, I liked Jaden Hood a lot. I thought his closing speed was remarkable. I thought he's a big hitter who, you don't want to compare players in this way because it's not fair to them, but he looks a little bit like Devin Bush in the way he plays and his speed and ability to hit hard off of speed. So of the guys I've looked at, I was happy to see they were able to keep him in the class, and I think he has a good future for Michigan.
Yeah, he might be a little if you watch him with Aquinas this year, you might be a little down on him.
Okay.
He has been in the transition process, new scheme, new responsibility, a whole lot of talent around him, but a lot of expectation too for a performance at the position. So when I went to see him play, you could tell he was still learning. So he wasn't playing as fast as you had seen on film. But I think what you bring up, Craig, is a very important point. If you want to have an appreciation for what he can be, you got to watch his – you really got to look at his film so you know what it looks like when the guy knows the defense. So, I mean, a guy that's learning the defense, you can see that can make you play – what do they call it, paralysis by analysis?
Mm-hmm.
Where a guy can be – really, really, held back, slow to the punch because he's thinking. out there on the football field, and you can see that a lot with him when I went to play. But things have gotten better as the season has gone on. They have a state championship game coming up. But he was a guy, I mean, up until yesterday, he was a guy that was going to wait, was hearing from a lot of other schools. Florida State made a late push. You know, you had Miami making a late push at Jaden McBurrows, Alabama making a late push at Xavier Worthy. I mean, they had some guys in serious question here down the stretch, and it made it for the most drama-laden signing day that I can recall. And you had a lot of guys in this class that said, hey, you know what, I'm going to the University of Michigan no matter what. That, too, is unique about this class to me, guys.
Yeah, I want to give credit to some of the recruits in this class for holding it together. I think J.J. McCarthy, you know, and Junior Colson, you know, a guy already on the team, Diamond Green Warren, his family, like, organized that trip for Wisconsin where, like, all these guys got together in Ann Arbor, separate from the coaches, separate from the program, and just gave themselves an Ann Arbor weekend, just like any other student would drive up to see Michigan when you're, you know, when you're thinking about going there. And I think that this class, I mean, this probably happens with every single class, right? The quarterback starts the text exchange, and they all talk to each other. It seems like this class has been on another level. And I get a little bit of information because one of the guys plays for a program that a friend of mine used to coach about, like, what's going on in those text threads. And there has been a lot of, you know, talking, not just talking about Michigan, but talking about, like, what they want out of Michigan outside of who the coaching staff is, outside of anything else, right? They just, they have an idea, this class, what they want to do. And that, I think, held this class together as much as anything the coaches did.
Yeah, I agree. I think J.J. McCarthy said, you know, big question with him. I mean, you got to believe that he's going to be in the mix for the job. You know, who, whatever the quarterback situation is at Michigan with regard to who stays and who goes among the guys that they have on the roster now, J.J. McCarthy is going to have a chance to win that job. And coming in early, if the offense stays the same, or even if it doesn't, I mean, it still gives them a leg up in learning whatever the offense is that they're going to play. He has a leg up by enrolling early. I think he's going to be definitively in the mix, guys, and we'll have a legit chance. I mean, maturity-wise, you know, work ethic-wise, I think that he'll be a guy that's legitimately in the mix for that starting position. I wonder what you guys think.
I mean, I suppose, given what we saw at quarterback this year, but and even if he is a five-star, having a true freshman legitimately in the competition for a starting job is not a good
thing. It is not.
So, like, what are we looking at here? We're looking at a situation where Michigan is likely to improve from 2-4 this year to what? I mean, and is that, like, a level where you're comfortable, like, going into another year with Jim Harbaugh? And it's just, I don't know. It kind of feels like we're in a little bit of a situation where there aren't a whole lot of good answers unless Michigan gets really lucky.
Well, it leads into the question about the timeline. I mean, we had a lengthy discussion last week about what direction we thought this was going to go, what some of the possibilities are in either direction. We did not get into how long we thought it was going to take. And so now the season is officially over. Does this get done like that? I'm talking about just as it relates to Jim Harbaugh. Does that decision get made like this? Or do you guys think it's going to take some time to get to the conclusion, whatever it is with Jim Harbaugh?
Go ahead, Brian.
They're not going to get any more data right now. So if they haven't agreed to an extension, that would be the only reason they haven't signed one yet. And there's maybe that's because they're some way apart and they're still working on it. And maybe it's because they're going to go in a different direction. And the NFL might have something to say about that. But I don't know.
You know, my best guess is this. There's no way that Ward Manuel or the athletic department wants to go into next year with Jim Harbaugh on a one-year deal.
No.
I mean, they don't want to be trying to recruit through the summer and next fall with, I don't know, let's see how the season goes, particularly when I agree with Brian. There's not a lot to say that next year is going to be a stellar or vintage Michigan year. It's, you know, it's just not likely from where we can sit right now. So they've got to get a deal done, or they've got to make some sort of change of some sort. If that quote change could be an extension of Harbaugh. And my guess is the problem has to be on the buyout. because a Moore Emanuel can't put himself in the situation of sitting there with another $10 million buyout on his coach if everyone in the community is clamoring that this just can't keep going on. And so to me, you know, it makes sense really to extend Harbaugh, to me at least, but it doesn't make sense to extend him without a lowball buyout at the very least. I mean, to $1 million maybe, something that's doable in the long run.
I think that would definitely be a sticking point. I think that definitely would be a sticking
point. And to me, that's what's got to be the problem. And, you know, so especially with the pandemic and the fact that you don't know you're going to have a full stadium next year. You don't know if you're going to have 10,000 people in the stadium next year and what revenues are going to look like. And so money is salient, more so than ever. And, you know, like I mentioned before, I have friends who keep saying, oh, yeah, someone will come in and just give Michigan $20 million, $30 million, whatever. Well, yeah, easy to say. I'm not so sure.
You know what? Yeah. Hey, I hear you. And I agree with everything you just said, Craig. Yeah. I think there's a difference between, you know, low base and low buyout. You know, the low base part, I think that's where the discussion that people or the issue that people were raising about potentially ego getting in the way. I do not get that. I do not get that sense from talking to people who know Jim that I think he would sign a contract for less. But the buyout is not an ego thing. The buyout is a security thing.
Yes.
And I think, exactly. You know, I think that distinction needs to be made. And so I do think if the question is ego, not an issue. Security, issue. And I don't know how, you know, if that elongates the process, you know, does that encourage him to look around more? I don't even know that you know the staff changes that he was, you know, he probably had some retooling in mind anyway. I don't even know that would be as much of an issue as the low buyout.
Yeah, let me ask all you guys a question because this is something that I have no instinct for at all. But I think someone, maybe Brian, brought it up on his board, and that's or in his site. The that yesterday there was all kinds of tweeting, which I don't get involved with, obviously, from the offensive staff. And in fact, if you look at the offensive side of recruiting yesterday, you look at it and say, oh, this looks like about same as always at Michigan. Looks pretty good, right? The defensive coaches, there was no noise at all, apparently. And does that have any meaning? Is that just sort of random? Is that, you know, what do you, but it was something that was brought up.
Yeah, it was. Scott Bell tweeted it out, and yeah, and here's the thing. The list of guys who were tweeting, Ed Warner tweets a lot, Josh Gattis tweets a lot, Sharon Moore tweets a lot, Jay Harbaugh tweets a lot. Those guys, if you're following Coach Twitter, you're going to hear from them all the time anyway. Don Brown, I don't see him. Like, he doesn't tweet very much. Like, they make a graphic for him to put out once in a while. Sean Nua, no, he like works behind the scenes mostly. Bob Shoup, whatever. Ben McDaniels, I don't ever hear from him. Zordich, does he know what Twitter is? and Brian Jingmeri, who I don't think tweets very much either. So, like, I don't read anything into that. I do think that there's there may be a correlation. I don't necessarily think there's causation.
Yeah, I think that they're all in the same boat. I don't think that they've been told anything.
Yeah. I think it's pretty clear. Bob Shoup obviously is gone because whatever happened this year does not warrant retaining that guy. And I would guess that Sean Nua is pretty much gone because Quentin Somerville left, and Somerville was Sean Nua's guy. So that was one of the guys they lost out of the class, was the one guy that like was most tied to Sean Nua, and all of a sudden flips, and that pretty much tells me that he's gone.
Yeah, I think that I don't think that any of them have been told anything. Now, if that is that doesn't mean that you know some of the speculation about who's going, who's staying won't wind up being right. I'm just saying it at this point in time. Any decision that a kid made to not come, I don't think is tied to knowledge of a decision that this guy won't be back or that guy won't be back. I definitely think that we are talking about a situation with the coaches where they are in the dark.
I'm sure they are, but I also worked for a print magazine company in 2008 when the economy crashed and everyone looked around and go, how much is print actually going to be involved in media in the future? And everyone knew. Everyone kind of looked around and we like, okay, that magazine's probably gone. This guy hasn't been performing. This guy did some things that were really cool. He's probably safe, right? This guy is tied to this important advertiser. He's probably safe. Everyone knew, even if you didn't know. And then, like, when it came down, maybe it was one surprise or two surprises. But, you know, they're everywhere. Of course, they're in a waiting period, and no one's going to be saying anything. But it's not hard to read the situation. If Michigan was going to offer Harbaugh a contract that was going to chew away NFL interest, they would have, and he would have signed it. If Michigan doesn't want to offer a contract that would shoo away NFL interest, Harbaugh would absolutely want to see what the NFL has to offer. I think that both of them make complete sense from both parties, and there's a lot of area in there where they can agree on a contract for 3 years afterwards. But if Michigan wanted to pay that kind of, had that kind of security, you know, they would have offered it. I don't think that they want to. I don't think that they have to. And I think that, you know, Harbaugh is going to have to either sign it or he's going to find another job.
The timeline, though, how long do you guys, to get back to the original question, how long does it take to get to the conclusion as it relates to Jim Harbaugh?
Right now, I'm not sure it's really that important. I mean, I think it's not like it has to be tomorrow or the day after. I mean, should it get done by January? Probably. But, you know, they've got another signing date in February, but there's not going to be a lot of kids involved in that. But it's reasonable, because I hope this would be the case. If Harbaugh isn't the coach, I would assume Michigan would tell their kids, hey, anybody who wants to go can go. Wouldn't you? I mean, isn't that fair to the kids? I mean, it seems to me they should, you know, it seems like, just to be fair to the kids that are in this class, they should have some instinct about whether Harbaugh is staying or going in the next few weeks at least. But I don't think it's a day-by-day imminence in terms of importance. You know, I'm going to guess Harbaugh is going to be the coach next year. I mean, that's my instinct, and I'm going to guess they're going to work it out some way, shape, or form, and there is going to be an extension. But I don't have any inside information. I don't talk to Ward Manuel. He has no idea who I am, I'm sure. But that's just how it feels. That's the sort of feel. That's the texture of everything, including the fact that the recruiting class yesterday, as Brian pointed out, stayed remarkably intact. So the texture of it feels like, yeah, he's going to be back next year. And probably to do that and make that be sensible, they're going to have to work out some deal for some sort of an extension. So I think that's a reasonable prediction.
Any theories on timeline, Brian?
Well, you know, the class is signed, and don't think there's going to be much movement. So you know, you've got until February for the second signing period. So, yeah, you could take a month here if you wanted. And I don't think it'll take that long. I think they'll come to some sort of agreement. But, yeah, it's you know, Ace on our podcast had a really good point, is that Ward Manuel doing this exactly right and Ward Manuel doing nothing could look exactly the same.
Exactly the same, yeah.
So, yeah, it's really up in the air.
By the way, athletic department, I know you listen to this show. I'm volunteering my services as a mediator for free. I will mediate these differences. I will charge you nothing. I will do it for nothing. And my results at mediating cases much more difficult than this is about 98% within 3 hours.
They're you know, the dates, the deadlines on this are January 3rd is the last NFL games, and that's the last NFL Sunday except for the playoffs. I don't think any playoff teams are firing their coaches. So that's when you'll have an idea of the NFL market. And I definitely want them to get it done before mid-January, because you have to hire some if you're hiring a new coach, then geez, like you're, you know, you want to get that in as soon as possible. But if you're going to have to hire a bunch of assistants, and you're going to have to be able to sell those assistants to recruits. And in order to do that, you're going to have to know who you got. So I don't want to be going into mid-January with Sean Newa still on the staff if that guy's not going to be coaching here next year.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the pacing of this is. I think the expectation, and the reason why I got into that question from a lot of fans, is that season's over, boom, it's going to get done. Yeah. I mean, some people, hey, don't be surprised if it doesn't go that way. As a matter of fact, I expect it to go into at least the early part of the new year. Just my opinion. I've been looking at that January 3rd date too, Seth, as being one of significance. So we'll see how it goes. But we got to get to a break. Be back on the other side here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050. MCO Blog Roundtable, Sports Talk 1050, WTK, The Ticket.
When we come back, can I whine a bit about basketball officiating?
You're on the radio.
Oh, we're on the radio.
Yeah, we can get basketball for sure.
Why are you complaining about basketball officiating?
Because Larry Sirota had the worst game any official in the Big Ten
They called the charge, one of the most ridiculous.
Yeah, he cut the inadvertent whistle, the fake walk on Wagner, and the ridiculous charge, the worst call I've seen this year by far by any ref, was all Sirota.
Wagner also had he got bumped and he was in his shooting motion and they didn't put him on the line. I was like,
yeah. Well, but that was, Borowski had a bad game too. Courtney Green was okay. Borowski had a terrible game too, but at least you can look at Borowski's calls and say, okay, you blew it, but it's understandable. Sirota's calls were so bad. I mean, they were impossible to even rationalize.
Have you noticed this is a trend against Penn State
with
Sirota?
Yeah, we have. Yeah.
But does he have some affiliation with Penn State? Is he a Penn State guy?
I don't know.
Randomly,
I don't know.
Conspiracy theories.
I'm always in for conspiracy theories, but but last night I watched Ohio State and Purdue. I don't know if you've seen any of this guy at Purdue, this freshman, the 7'4" guy,
Zach Edey.
Oh. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, he looks more like Lurch than the usual 7'4" Purdue center.
Where do you think he was ranked, Craig? Like, what do you think his recruiting ranking was?
400, 500?
That's exactly right. He was in the 400s.
Yeah.
And, I think I would rank that guy a little higher.
Me too. I mean, he's not going to do a whole lot for you on offense right now, but he's a freshman. But defensively and on the defensive boards, he's not terrible. And he was a factor last night. Now, Ohio State didn't have Liddell last night, but Purdue pretty much took it to him, even with Purdue taking some of the worst shots I've ever seen. I mean, Painter must have been going crazy. They took so much garbage, you couldn't believe it, but they still won.
Yeah, I haven't seen Purdue yet. I mean, so this guy that you're talking about, it looks more like Lurch than Isaac Haas?
Yes.
He is listed at 7'4", 285.
Back on Radio 1 Minute, guys. That's a large young man.
Yeah, he's big. He's big. Now,
can he move it all? I haven't really seen him play. Can he move it all?
No. He has trouble getting up and down the court. And offensively, he's like hopeless. Or I'm not hopeless, but he's way away.
He just turns the ball over too much. He's shooting 70% from the floor. So on high usage. So that's not a bad situation.
Back on Radio 30, Sam. I'll bring it back and take it from him.
Yeah, you're probably more accurate on that, Brian. That's probably right. But he's not good on offense right now. But I think he has potential to become an offensive player. But defensively, he's consequential. He's something, he's a pain in the ass for an offensive team. And so he's very interesting. And you're right. If he was number 400, they didn't come close to evaluating him. He's from Toronto, I think.
And by Gosh Radio?
Yeah.
I think he was at IMG and wasn't playing very much.
Okay.
Also, Sasha Stefanovic has zero made twos this year.
Is that right?
Now time for the second half of the MGoBlog Roundtable here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTK. The ticket online at WTK.com. The MGoBlog Roundtable is brought to you by Homeshore Lending. If you're looking for a mortgage and you're a Michigan fan, there's only one place to go, Homeshore Lending, both fair and honest. Homeshore Lending is local, efficient, and small enough so you'll work directly with the owner, Matt Demarest. For more information, go to homeshorelending.com.
And we are back, folks, here on the Michigan Insider. Sports Talk 1050 WTKA online at WTK.com. Segue a bit and get some Michigan basketball in. Next time they see the court, it'll be Christmas Day. They're taking on Nebraska. A nip-tuck affair with Penn State in their most recent game. Big Ten play is officially upon us. What do you know? How do you feel about this team? How do you feel about how they stack up? I know we touched on this a little bit in a brief way recently, but we got a little broader sample space. Maybe know a little bit more about the other teams. Maybe you feel a little bit better about how much you know about Michigan as well. What do you see when you look at the Wolverines now that Big Ten play is officially here?
Well, I the Penn State game had problems for Michigan. The biggest problem was Penn State shot ball 20 more times. 20 more shots is a lot of shots, and you're going to be very lucky to win a game where the other team shot it 20 more times. And part of that was we got killed on the offensive boards, and we just turned it over way, way, way too many times. I mean, we just got killed in that number. So they end up with 20 more shots in the game. Another thing, though, was the Big Ten officiating, that crew was terrible. And what they allowed to happen in that game was what the Big Ten says cannot happen, what the NCAA says cannot happen. We're not going to allow two hand checks on the perimeter. We're not going to allow arm bars. We're going to allow freedom of movement off the ball. None of that happened in this game. Penn State came out, clutched and grabbed, held off the ball, arm barred on the perimeter, and they let it all go. And it was a terribly officiated game. Larry Sirota, worst game I've seen by an official in a long, long time. Fake whistle in a 2-point game, costing Michigan 2 points. In a so-called inadvertent whistle, in clutch or down in the key time, a fake travel call on Franz Wagner. I watched it slow motion twice. There ain't nothing there. And then the worst call I've seen by any official this year at the end of the first half on Mike Smith, who gets tripped going to the basket, makes the free layup. It should be an and one. Instead, it's a charge. There's a lot of block charges are hard. This one was not. Even the announcers are like, I don't see that. Yeah, and because it wasn't there. And it was such a bad call that it's impossible to believe that any human could actually make that call. And it's stunning that Courtney Green and Borowski didn't step in and say, no, this is just not even close. And so it truly was a terrible game in that. But Michigan has a lot to blame blame on their own.
And yet, those terrible refs knew the rule about the backboard. If the ball goes off the backboard below the rim, and no point in the basketball is above the rim, then it's not a goaltend. Right. Which I didn't know that rule. I don't think people who know basketball a lot better than I do knew that rule. But they knew the rule, and they called it correctly.
Yeah, they did call it correctly. And the thing is, I don't think Borowski historically is a terrible ref. I think he's actually pretty good. I think Sirota had one bad game with us last year, but he's mostly pretty good. But this one was really hard to figure out. I mean, because it was so inept. Maybe they just had bad games. Players have bad games. Refs have bad games. The thing I liked about the game was how well Juwan is handling Hunter Dickinson's minutes. And people were questioning early on in the season, well, they're starting Austin Davis, they're not getting off to great starts. But you got a big guy like this, you want him to be available at the end of the games. And in this game, he sat out quite a bit, but it took a lot of patience from Juwan to do that, but he did it. And so, when it was important, they had Hunter Dickinson on the court. And so congratulations to Juwan for having the patience and foresight to see what was happening with the officiating in that game to make sure that Hunter was on the court when they needed him on the court. So, you know, congrats there. The other question I've got, or long question, is Terrence Williams, who I really like, who didn't get any minutes till right at the end. And I'm not sure that Williams can't play some center. He did in high school, played it pretty well in high school, and in this game he'd be going against a guy 3 inches taller who really isn't a major offensive force and is a lot less athletic. And so I'd like to see that tried out a little bit, because they did have some problems when Dickinson was off the court in this game again at the center position, particularly with Austin Davis being sort of problematic in terms of what, you know, what's going on with him.
Yeah, I don't know about that one, because, you know, Brandon Johns had a rough game offensively, 4 turnovers, like 12
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah.
But he also was able to execute pick and roll coverage as a center very well. He had a lot of foul-free contesting in this game. Like he had his moments where he wasn't familiar with the center position and gave up something. But I think from a verticality perspective, like who's going to contest shots at the rim, Brandon Johns has a huge advantage on Terrence. He's a couple inches taller. He's much more athletic. So if Michigan, I mean, they should be just stuffing Brandon Johns' face with center at this point, both for this year and down the road, because, you know, going into this year, the most uncomfortable part of the roster is the fact that you only had two centers. For a lot of reasons, you're always going to need to have at least an emergency backup at the five. So I thought Johns, I mean, people correctly noted that he was having a rough game on offense, but defensively he did a really good job. And there's a reason that Penn State shot 28% from two when he was part of that reason.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, Ryan. I just think his ability to defend on the perimeter, he's athletic, you can switch with him, and he is bothersome around the rim. I think that if you go to Terrence Williams there, you're riding his, you know, he can be a really physical guy. I think he certainly has adequate quickness on the perimeter, but he gives up so much in height. He gives up so much in rim protection that I think that if you're choosing between those two, which is what we're talking about here, I don't know how you could, you know, regularly choose a Terrence Williams in that mix. Now, in a situational sort of way, like you're in a Penn State game where maybe the height factor isn't as much of an issue and Brandon Johns might be struggling offensively, maybe you consider it situationally, but I can't imagine that that's something that they would, hey, we gotta try to do this as a part of the Austin Davis list plan, if you will. I'm curious, though, we talked about this before, guys, and not to raise it as a concern, but, you know, that moment where Franz Wagner takes over an offensive game, or takes over a game offensively, I know you guys raised a great point last week where you said, hey, it's going to look different. You know, Franz Wagner's impact on a game is going to look different this year maybe than we anticipated based on what everything else they have on the roster. Hell, they have a big man that's a go-to guy already. So I get that. But are you not expecting at some point to see – I mean, even in this last game against Penn State, I kept – you know, is there going to be this moment where the Franz Wagner that looks like all Big Ten Franz Wagner is going to emerge? I imagine, I know that that's there. I wonder how long you guys think it's going to take for us to see that. See it.
Well, I mean, I think actually Franz is playing pretty well and has picked up his game a lot from last year. I think watch his feet on defense. I mean, last year he tended to be flat-footed a lot. This year he's moving his feet. His defense on the perimeter is a lot better. Secondly, he's rebounding pretty well. I think he might be right around 7 rebounds a game, and I think that's pretty good.
I guess I need to be specific. Okay. You know, I'm not suggesting that Franz is playing poorly.
No, I think he's playing well.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting that at all. But this is lottery pick performance. Franz is what I'm talking about.
Well,
that's a consistent discussion. As you're watching the games and you see people on Twitter or you see people on the message board, which is obviously not necessarily the guide, but that sort of cursory glance, man, he is taking over the game offensively. I think that's the kind of showing that you know, a lot of people were expecting heading into this season. Now, he could still be a really, really effective guy like he is and not be that. I'm asking you, do you expect that to emerge at some point where, hey, he's a dominant offensive force that is taking over a game offensively?
For him to do that, doesn't it imply that he's going to have to shoot the ball from three? And I don't think that's happening. I mean, I've said this for 2 years. One, he shoots the ball from way too low, and you can always tell when a kid learns to shoot. If he learns to shoot young, they all do that, too young. And so they shoot the ball from low, and even though he's 6'9", it's going to be more difficult for him than a 6'5 or 6'6 Tim Hardaway, for example, who shoots the ball from way over his head and has an actual jump shot. And so it's you know, so it isn't going to be easy for him to create his own shot from the perimeter. Secondly, I only think he's going to make 30%. He's, you know, 30, 31, 32% right now. That's what it looks like to me.
25% right now, I think.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's a limited sample. I think he was around 30 or 20. I think he was something just slight of 30 last year.
31 last year.
31, thanks, Brian. So, and I think that's where he's going to be, 30, 31, 32 at the most. And so I think it's going to be hard for him to be a lottery pick at least. Now, someone's going to take a chance on him because he can do a lot of stuff on a basketball court, including pass it pretty well. If he needs to shoot from perimeter to be a lottery pick, well, I don't see that happening right now. Maybe in a year or two it's possible.
I'm going to try to actually answer the question, which is, so I was expecting that you might see Franz Wagner kind of emerge into a sophomore year Stauskas role where he becomes Michigan's primary pick and roll ball hand. And that's obviously not the case. So it's going to be Mike Smith when Mike Smith's on the floor. And Eli's done a better job of probing and getting to the bucket. And Franz has had a couple opportunities, but really hasn't emerged into that role. I don't think he's going to emerge into that role. So where does he get his offense from? Well, I mean, attacking closeouts, but how hard are you going to close Franz Wagner out given the fact that he isn't shooting that well from the outside? You know, the other thing that I think he could up his usage with is that duck in a couple of games ago where they have the horn set and they go across the top of the ducks against a guy who's 6 inches shorter than him. That's a spot where I feel like Michigan really needs to emphasize Franz Wagner as a guy who's moving off the ball and catching the ball near the basket and able to go to work, because he's so long and he's playing the two or three most of the time that he's going to have a huge advantage when he's able to do that. So cutting off the ball is something he needs to be a lot better at, because he is a rare combination of, you know, agility at 10. So I don't expect a guy who takes over and blows up into a 25% guy at any point. But he's at 17 right now, and, you know, he shot 61% from two last year. He's shooting 61% this year. You just got to do whatever you can do to get him to anything.
Mm-hmm. Seth? Yeah, I mean, he's been a dominant at the rim. And every time he goes to the rim, it's been either, you know, he's a great free throw shooter if he gets fouled, and if he doesn't get fouled, it's going in almost every single time. He's taken about as many two-point jumpers as he's taken three-point jumpers this year, and they're not going in as much. I think they're both around 25%, 28%. So I didn't even think about Craig's point about him having a kind of a low shot from the perimeter. But there's been just times when he's passed up perimeter shots too. And I think that, like, if those start going in, well, then you got to pull him out of there. They also, I mean, you know, he's not been the primary pick and roll guy, but they're running a lot of their offense through Hunter Dickinson. Like, I don't think anyone, when we were predicting Franz to be, like, the originator of the offense this year, I don't think any of us were thinking this center is going to come in and be one of the most dominant centers in the Big Ten. And the fact that they can do that kind of takes that away from Franz, which doesn't really take away from Franz. He's still a very effective player. It's just that's not on his plate because Dickinson does it so well. And I think that's fine. Like, I don't think he wants to be that player necessarily. And the gains that he's made on defense, the effect he's had on defense is so important right now that if maybe he's putting more effort into that, that I'm fine with it. Like, if we're shifting some of his offensive creation and then he's focusing more on just, like, you know, which closeouts, because on ball, he's been one of our best defenders this year and one of the best that Michigan's had in, you know, throughout the last 10 years. He is a he's getting lost a little bit sometimes. And Livers is too sometimes. And I think the communication on defense is part of the problems that they've been having with their perimeter defense lately. And that's the only thing that's standing between them and being a good defense right now.
Wait, what problems with the perimeter defense? Penn State got up 17 threes in this game, and two of them were for Trent Buttrick. They put up 46 other shots. Like, yeah, they've had some switching issues that they'll get resolved, but they are dominant defending two-pointers, and perimeter defense isn't just threes, right? Perimeter defense involves being able to defend guys when they drive to the bucket, and Michigan is, you know, eighth in the country. People are shooting 37% from two.
Yeah, I don't want to overstate the point.
They're average-ish at preventing threes, and I think they're going to get better as they get more acquainted to each other, because there's been a lot of turnover on this team, too. So, I mean, I just can't. You got to think about the whole defense and not just the fact that sometimes there are some open threes.
No, I don't want to overstate the point. I'm thinking that with his on-ball defense, Michigan's and with Livers out there and with Brooks out there, they and Shaunte Brown, geez, like this could be. They have the potential for an elite defense, and one of the only things they're kind of giving up sometimes is they do fall asleep a little bit at the perimeter. I don't want to make it sound like I'm saying they're a bad perimeter defense, because they're absolutely not. And I think what I'm really saying is that his effort has been going towards that, and I like that. I think that like Hunter Dickinson allows you to take that off of Franz's plate and has allowed Franz to probably focus a little bit more on defense, and you're seeing it on defense, and then you're seeing it in the team's performance.
So as you look at the Big Ten now, what's the team that you've been most impressed by or impressed with?
Iowa.
You know, Illinois. Sorry, you go into this year and you think, oh, Iowa's in the top five. That's ridiculous, because they're going to have a defense that's like 80th. And it turns, and like the way out from them is not to be better on defense. It's to have like the full-on 2014 Beeline Nick Stauskas year, where you are so incredible at offense that you just outdistance your defense, and that's exactly what they're doing. So you have Garza back, you have Frederick back, you get Bohannon back off an injury. Everybody on that team except Joe Toussaint can shoot. Jack Nunji is a great backup, 5'11", got some stretch to him, really emerging into a real player there, and just there's nobody they put on the court that's not a plus offensive player. So they're going to be a load.
Well, I agree they're a load. I still think that Illinois and will win the Big Ten. I think they're the most talented team overall. I think Iowa, Michigan State will battle for 2-3. And then it's everybody else. And I think Michigan has a good chance of being sitting in that four slot, has a good chance there. I think the one another thing I like about Michigan right now is they're not a particularly selfish team, remarkably unselfish, even with guys who are looking to find their way into the NBA. I haven't seen a lot of forced shots. There have been a few, but not a lot. So I think Michigan has a chance of competing with just about everyone. But right now, those look like the top three to me. I don't know what you guys think of Michigan State and Illinois, but those are two teams that I do really like.
I mean, the interesting thing about Michigan State is if you go to Bart Torvik and you drop out his preseason projections, they're 50. So
yeah,
they've had some issues, and we got to see if Duke is actually any good this year. So
they did win last night, I think, didn't they, against Notre Dame, I believe.
So they're better than Kentucky. That's,
yeah.
That's what we know.
Yeah, State beat Notre Dame as well this year. I don't know if Notre Dame's any good.
No, they're not. I'll just put that out there. They're not very good at basketball. So, yeah, I mean, Illinois has been impressive, too. I just feel like they have these stretches where they you got Io trying to run the show by himself, and they just don't look as polished. And then is Kofi going to overwhelm Garza as a rebounder so it doesn't matter? And that's a possibility. I mean, I think those are going to be great games. The great thing about the Big Ten is that unlike pretty much every football season, there's a lot of intrigue, right? It's like, oh, I can't wait to see these two teams play because I don't know who's going to win. So there's four or five teams at the top of this conference, and any of them could come out on top. You know, even Indiana's in the top 20 on KenPom, which I don't think is going to last, but they're improved. Rutgers.
Rutgers is a good team.
You have a breakout performance from Ron Harper. Jacob Young is like kind of efficient. It's
no.
I mean, it's. I'm surprised that
will they be able to shoot enough to be an emerging team is what I wonder about them.
Yeah, I mean that's fair enough. They still have kind of a janky offense, but it looks much better this year.
They're going to D up. That team will D up, and they're going to play you hard.
Penn State, Michigan goes into Penn State, and they play, and you're just watching this team, and you're like, this team is actually pretty good. They got a couple of roster holes that's going to make it hard for them to do much better than 500, but they have some players, and I think that's the case for everybody except two teams in this conference.
Well, fellas, that brings us to the conclusion of this MGO Blog Roundtable, and not just the conclusion of this MGO Blog Roundtable today, but the conclusion of the MGO Blog Roundtable for the year, as we are not going to be on next Thursday. So I want to wish all three of you guys happy holidays. It's such a wealth of perspective on a weekly basis. I appreciate it. I know the listeners appreciate it. So again, enjoy yourselves. When we come back in the new year, we certainly will be much deeper into the basketball discussions at that point. So I'm looking forward to that. But thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate all three of you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ira.